Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay, there's also weaker interpretations and so on and so forth. Okay, and Jos will fill you in on all of that. So strong interpretation is that, I'll just write it down and then we'll talk about it. Particle cannot simultaneously possess So a particle cannot simultaneously possess a definite position and a definite momentum at the same time. Okay, so to say that it has a definite position means what about delta x, about our uncertainty in its position? Very low. If it's definite, if we know definitely where the particle is, how can we, in our particle in the box, how can we be know definitely where the particle is in the world? How could we do that? We make the box really, really small. We got a particle in that box. I know that particle is in this box here. We got it trapped in there. What I do is I squeeze the box and make it really, really tiny. Okay, now I've got this tiny, weeny little box. I know the particle's in there. I've localized its position. I know for sure. I don't know where in the box it is, but the box is really small. So I've but I know the particle's in this very small space. Okay, so
it could not be.
That's the point. That's exactly the point. So to say that it has a definite position means that our uncertainty in the position is zero, okay, or there is no uncertainty in its position. It occupies a definite position. It is at a definite location. It is at x equals 5, period.
Well, that, if this is true, then that couldn't occur, right?
Exactly, that's the point. So, and simultaneously, okay, and to say that it has a definite momentum means that the momentum is exactly 5 kilogram meters per second with no uncertainty. Okay, so that's what it means to say definite. So that means our uncertainty in momentum is zero. Okay, and so what the Heisenberg, according to this interpretation of the Heisenberg uncertainty, it's saying that you can't have that. You can't have this thing zero and this thing zero at the same time, because zero times zero is zero, but we need a number on the right-hand side here that's bigger than h over 4 pi. In a Newtonian universe, there is no Planck's constant, and this is just zero on the right-hand side. And you can have a definite position and a definite momentum simultaneously. But in the quantum world, we can't have both of these zero at the same time. Yeah. So there are interpretations in which it's saying, see, the weaker interpretation is that you can't measure both of them with infinite precision. But the particle can have, yeah. That's it, yeah.
So does this equation destroy the idea of like absolute rest then? Because if you can't occupy an exact position or have an exact momentum at the same time, then you must always be.
Yeah, so to say that the particle is just sitting there, so what it's saying is you can't have a particle just sitting there. Because if a particle is just sitting there at some definite location, right, then delta x is zero and it has no momentum because it's just sitting there. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
It's more disturbing, so the particle has a definite position at the moment.
Yeah, so okay, so the weaker one says that if you make a measurement and you measure the position of the particle to an accuracy of delta x, so your detector is, say, this big, and so you know I've detected the particle somewhere in this region, then by making that measurement, you introduce an uncertainty in its momentum, whose magnitude will be delta p is greater than or equal to, just bringing the delta x down here, h over 4 pi delta x. So the more certain I am of its position, the more accurately I measure its position, the more I disturb it and give it an arbitrary random momentum. And so my uncertainty momentum of the particle at the same time as I know its position has increased.
Well, not according to the strong interpretation. So I could interpret this also as saying that the particle simply does not possess a definite position and momentum simultaneously. So there are just different interpretations of that one relation. Yeah.
Because this law like works only for small particles, right? But where is this border between does it stop working?
That's a hugely important question. So the question is, all of this weirdness that's going on at the level of atoms and subatomic particles and so on, that's all fine and well, and it's all really cool, and maybe we can do cool things with it, et cetera, et cetera. But as we make systems bigger and bigger and bigger, until we get to the size of people in this room, we don't see this kind of behavior and so on. So where exactly does that transition happen?
So it's like this.
That's
like
an open question.
This like diminishes, when going for bigger and bigger objects, right? It's like it stops at one point. And
yeah. I mean, suppose it's true that this whole quantum nature continues all the way up to this sort of classical level. Okay. Then because H is so small, okay, when I measure your position. Okay, your position is being measured to a certain accuracy. This number is actually fairly big, even though we try to make it really, really small. It's fairly big compared to atoms. Okay, so this number is actually fairly big. So our uncertainty position needn't be super, super large. Okay, so at the level of objects that are the size of people in this room and so on, this relationship doesn't really have any bearing. Yeah.
Although you see they can't simultaneously possess a definite position of momentum.
Yeah.
But can delta x ever be zero?
So delta x could be zero. If you had his super accurate particle detector, then. So delta x could be zero, but in that case delta p would be huge.
Wouldn't it violate that though? I mean, if delta x was
exactly zero. That's right. So in the limit, the delta x becomes really, really, really small. Delta p becomes really, really, really large.
This would actually say then that delta x could never be zero, right? So you could never be sure exactly of the definite position.
But delta p could be simply infinite. Okay.
Infinity is zero.
No. Zero times infinity is anything. Okay, and it depends upon the way something goes to zero and the way something goes to infinity. Like, I can take, say, 1 over x times x as x goes to zero. As x goes to zero, this becomes an infinity and this goes to zero. But the product of those is just 1. Okay? Or I could take 5 over x. Okay? As x goes to zero, this goes to infinity, and this goes to zero. I'm multiplying infinity times zero, but the answer is now 5. So basically, zero times infinity is anything. Okay? But so in all of this stuff, let's just put it this way. In all this stuff, let's just say that we're not actually going to zero, we're just taking the limit. Okay, but we're not actually assigning the value to zero. Okay? Yeah.
You just multiplied velocity with mass, so you don't have any velocity that's higher than c.
So let me say this. That's a good point. That's a clever point. Okay. So let me say this. This important point is that all of this quantum mechanics that we're doing right now is based on Newton's picture of the universe. Okay. It turns out that because what are we doing? We're saying that all of the stuff we've done is based on this, E equals p squared over 2m. So kinetic energy is p squared over 2m. Okay, this is a formula which is valid in Newtonian mechanics. And that momentum is mass times velocity and so on. These are Newtonian concepts. In reality, we have, in relativity, we have E squared equals m squared c to the fourth plus p squared c squared. Okay. And so the relationship between energy and momentum is more complicated than this. In the limit of things moving slowly with respect to the speed of light, this reduces to, and do we have an exercise that we do this in? It's in the math primer thing. Yeah.
So this reduces to E equals mc squared, so it's approximately. If the speed of the object is much less than the speed of light, you can show that this relationship reduces to E is approximately mc squared plus p squared over 2m. Okay, so this is the usual kinetic energy term. This is the rest energy. This is the amount of energy something has just by virtue of its inertia. If you could convert that mass into pure energy, there's a lot of energy there. Okay, that's called the rest energy. This is just a constant. Okay? So all of the stuff that we're doing is non-relativistic, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay, but if you combine quantum ideas with relativity ideas, then you do get something which does make sense in the context of relativity, in the context of there being a speed limit in the universe. So this is this relationship here. Where does that come from? P equals mv. Yeah. So who? But someone wrote it down for the first time. Why? Why did they write that down?
What's the meaning of mv for? I think that she says that momentum can be infinite because when speed is very very large, like speed of light, mass also increases very very fast.
So all I'm saying is, yeah, sure, I agree. I understand that all the stuff we're doing is invalid when it comes to things moving near the speed of light. And what we have to do is take all of what we've been talking about and put it in the context of special relativity. And when you do that, then you get something called quantum field theory. And that results in predictions of things like there exist things like photons, certain properties of the electron, spin, and all kinds of stuff like that. So basically, if you take ordinary quantum mechanics and combine it with special relativity, you get this thing called quantum field theory. And I'll talk a little bit about quantum field theory shortly, but let me actually get to it. So let me just let's suppose that we're reasonably okay with that. Okay? And let's just say, let's just have a look at what it means. Because we do want to eventually break for lunch. Okay, so but you see, what's wonderful about quantum is that this mathematics is open to many interpretations. Okay? And there's this kind of debate happens like hugely in this institute. Okay? So anyway, so in the classical picture, like if half of those quantum foundations people were to hear me yakking about this, they'd be horrified, and the other half would be, yeah, that's all right. So, but if I were to say something different, then that first half would be happy, and the other half wouldn't. Okay, so whatever. It's a tightrope here. Okay, so in the classical world, the typical question that we ask is this. Okay, the typical question is, given the initial position and the initial velocity or equivalent momentum of a particle, what at t equals zero, say, what is the position and the momentum at some later time t? Okay, so a concrete example is I give you the initial position of the baseball and the initial momentum. So I give you x at time 0 and p at time 0. If I've given you that and I've told you that there's a gravitational field, et cetera, you apply f equals ma and you can tell me the trajectory of that particle. And you can tell me in particular the position and the momentum at any later time t. It's following some definite trajectory in space. Okay? This is time 0, and this is time t. Okay, so the point is, at any instant of time, the particle possesses a definite position and a definite momentum. As time goes on, first it's here with that momentum, then it's there with that momentum, and so on and so forth. At any instant of time, it possesses a definite position and momentum. So the fact that these guys are definite means that our uncertainty in position and our uncertainty in momentum are both 0. Okay? So the particle is on a definite trajectory. Or it can be on a definite trajectory. Or to be on a definite trajectory is
a necessary condition for that is delta x and delta p are both zero simultaneously, which we know in the quantum world can't be true. Okay, so, or according to the strong interpretation of the Heisenberg uncertainty. Okay, so now let's compare that with the quantum world, which is very different. So in the quantum world, so this is a typical question. In the quantum world, the typical question changes radically. So what the typical question is something like this. Given I know that the particle was at this position at time zero, using his infinitely accurate position detector, what is the probability of finding the particle at some position x at a later time t? Okay, or given that I saw a particle moving with some velocity at time zero or having some momentum at time zero, what is the probability of finding that it has some momentum p at some later time? Okay, so it's either or. It's not both. Okay, so let's focus on the first one, which is the usual one. Okay, given that I saw a particle at some position, what's the probability of finding it at some later position? So what I have in mind here, or helpful to give you a concrete example, is at t equals zero, I saw I know the particle is here. It just emerged from that detector. Okay, what is the probability that at some later time I will find it occurring here? Okay, so what's the probability it will hit the screen at that point there, or in some range here? Okay, that's the kind of question. So that's it. So what do we use to calculate that probability? Well, we don't use f equals ma. We use lambda equals h over p. Okay, so okay, we see that to calculate probability. See that probability there. Okay. So what I'm getting to is there's no such thing as a definite trajectory. Okay, so let me illustrate this. So in quantum mechanics, according to this strong or one interpretation of the Heisenberg uncertainty and quantum mechanics in general, what we are, sorry, was there a question? Did you have a question?
Yeah. Why can't I know the both at some time?
This should make you
think. Oh, did I say that wrong?
Oh, yeah. Because you can calculate both probabilities.
So let's just focus on this one over here, right? Are we okay with that? So what I'm saying is, I know the particle's here at this time. What's the probability to be there at a later time? That's the kind of question we're asking. Oh, because you can't know the initial position. So given that I know at t equals 0, the position is this, and the momentum is definitely this. So I can't know definitely both of them. That's why it's only either or.
Exact initial position is not anything about
the momentum. That's right. So if I know the initial position exactly, then I know nothing about its momentum.
Yes.
It could have any momentum.
So I can't say anything about where I'm going to find it at a different time.
Yeah, sure, I can. That's right. I can't say definitely where it's going to be, but I can give probabilities. let me say it this way. Suppose that I've got that particle, and I'm thinking in three-dimensional space, and I said, yes, it's right there. Okay, and then and I have this double slit apparatus over here. Okay, then there's an uncertainty in momentum that's introduced. Okay, so it has its momentum is totally uncertain. Okay, it could be in any direction. So then you say, well, first of all, there's only a 50% chance that the
particle has a momentum such as moving to the right. Okay, so I know there's a 50% chance that it will even like enter the region of this double slit apparatus. And then of those, of that 50%, I can say there's a certain percentage, roughly speaking, that it's going to be going through these slits. Maybe 10% that a particle is going to go through those slits as opposed to just bouncing off the barrier. And then of those 10% that are actually going through that slit, now I apply my usual double slit probability pattern, and I say, okay, so it's 10% times this probability, this usual probability curve. So even though the momentum is totally uncertain here, it could have gone off in any direction with perfect spherical symmetry, I can still say there's a certain probability that it will actually end up over there. So I can still calculate probabilities. Okay, so let me just end with this one thing here, which I think you're really going to like. Okay, so let's go back to the double slit. And let's think about this a bit more. This is a famous thought experiment due to Richard Feynman. Okay, so within a certain interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is called the Copenhagen interpretation, this is what he thought about here. So let's start with our double slit. And what we're saying here basically is, let's go back to the particle in the box. So for the particle in the box, what we had is that all we can do is talk about probability patterns. And when the particle is in a state like this, there's a wave that is associated with that particle, which is a standing wave. And that standing wave involves a right traveling and a left traveling wave, left moving, right moving wave. Okay, and so what we have is plus p and minus p. Okay, so we have both classical possibilities present simultaneously. Okay, in the double, if we apply that kind of reasoning here to the double slit experiment, then when we say, oh, okay, what's the probability that the particle, you know, I see it over here at this time, what's the probability it will end up somewhere on the screen at some later time? What's the probability, say, that it will end up over there? Okay. Well, in getting from there to there, there's two ways that it could happen classically. One way is it could go through that slit. The other is it could go through that slit. There are two possible paths. Okay? So there are two classical alternatives, two classical probabilities. In the same way that for the particle in the box, there are two classical alternatives. It's either plus p or it's bounced around and it's minus p. But in the quantum world, we can, so this is plus p or minus p. In the classical world. In the quantum world, we can have both of those alternatives present at the same time. Okay? So what quantum mechanics is saying is that, or in this interpretation of quantum mechanics, in the particle in getting from there to there exists simultaneously in this path as well as that path. Okay? In other words, at some instant of time, say here, the particle is simultaneously here and here. Okay? So that's what's being said. Okay? In this interpretation. Other interpretation, like the many worlds interpretation, says that basically the electron is going to make a decision to go this way or this way. The electron only goes this way or this way. But the universe essentially splits into two universes. In one universe, the electron goes this way, and the other universe, the electron goes that way. So every time a particle has a decision to make like this, the universe splits into two. In one universe, it does this, and the other universe, it does that. You can imagine that at the atomic level, zillions of such things are going on. Zillions of such things are going on in my baby finger. Okay, there are zillions. My baby finger is creating zillions of new universes every split second. Okay, so that's the other possibility. Okay, so whatever. Okay, so let's go with this one for now. Okay. So it's saying it exists simultaneously in these two states. Now think about this. This is a really cool thought experiment. Let's say that now instead of two slits, we add, say, a third slit over there. So
in the particle, for the particle, or the particle, and getting from there to there now, there are now three possibilities: this one, and that one. Okay. If we add another slit over here, that adds a fourth possibility. Okay. So now, in getting from there to there, the particle exists simultaneously in all four possible states. Okay, but what happens if we put another barrier here, like this, and introduce another slit, more slits? Okay, so here's another barrier, and we put, say, let's suppose we put a slit over there and another slit over there. Okay, so now the particle could do this, and then it has two possibilities, this or this. Or it could come this way and then go through this one or that one. Or it could come this way and go through that one and that one. Or it could come through this one and go through that one and that one. So we have 4 times 2 is 8 possible paths. Okay, and so the idea then is, in getting from there to there, the electron exists in all eight possible paths. Okay, so then Feynman just went to the limit of this and said, well, what if we stick a whole bunch of barriers in here, okay, and we introduce zillions of slits in each one of those barriers? Okay, so now it basically is a mess. So now we got these zillions of slits and or zillions of barriers with zillions of slits, and so it can go like this. That's one possibility. Another possibility is this one, right? Another possibility is this, and so on and so forth. And now let's introduce an infinite number of barriers with so many holes drilled in it that there's no more barriers. Okay, it's just empty space. And so the logical conclusion is that in getting from A to B here, the electron exists simultaneously in some weird way in all possible paths, including one that goes to the moon and comes all the way back. Okay? That's like really freaky. Okay? So there you go. So have some lunch on that one.